This show came out on Christmas Eve, so happy Christmas to those of you who celebrate it. I hope that Santa is going to visit Navient and Fedloan and hack into the computers, and they're going to just hack into that NSLDS, and Santa's just going to wipe out all of your debt. It's just going to be tremendous. Unfortunately, I'm not sure Santa's going to do that, even if you have been very nice. So happy Christmas to all who celebrate, and let's dive into the topic of today's episode, which is why student loans do not matter. That might sound like a little bit of a loaded comment, because you might think, well, shoot, if student loans didn't matter, I wouldn't be listening to your freaking show. I'm going to look at five different occupations for this holiday special episode, and we're going to look at five different paths and show you why the loans are not going to be the thing that would be holding this hypothetical person in each occupation back. I would suggest this holiday season that you give yourself the gift of no more anxiety about your loans, which hopefully you'll be able to see should be true when you look at the math and the details behind how all this stuff works. So let's look at occupation number one for this show. Let's say that you're a dentist. Maybe you're worried about Smile Direct. You're worried about all these different innovations that are going on in the dental field. You think that, you know, insurance trends are going to continue. You're going to continue to get declining coverage and reimbursement rates for your insurance coverages and the amount that insurance pays you to do procedures. It's gone down really drastically the past 10 years, and you think it's just going to keep getting worse. And on top of that, everybody and their grandmother seems to open up a DSO practice, a corporate dental group, and they buy up all these different practices. And it's just so hard to actually buy a decent dental practice that's not picked over by all these super wealthy groups that have all this money and access to capital that are buying them up, right? So you just feel overwhelmed, okay? And let's say on top of that, you have $500,000 of student loans and you just feel like you can't do anything. And, you know, you listen to some of the popular radio shows about personal finance and everything is living rice and beans. You just have to make a lot of money. You got to pay down all your debt, you know, take on additional debt to maybe own your own business is something that's real dangerous to do. Debt is the devil. You can't do anything with debt. So it kind of freaks you out. And so you're really stressed. And so maybe you do stay as an employee for a long time. Maybe you do work for 33% of the revenue that you're bringing in. That's like a typical number for those of you who are not a dentist for being basically an employee somewhere. Let's talk about that. If you became a owner of your own business, became a practice owner for this occupation example one, then you could bring in 40 to 50% of the revenues of the practice if it's exceptionally run. And then furthermore, beyond that, you'd also be getting the benefit of making more money, making a higher level of revenue on basically participating on everything in the practice instead of just what you produce. So for example, if you're an employee, you're only participating in the revenue of what you're actually producing. Whereas if you're an owner, then you participate in the revenue for everything the practice does. Maybe that's hygiene, maybe that's x-rays, whatever it is. I mean, different practices exclude a lot of different things from the calculation for which you get paid as an employee. So not only do you get a higher percentage of the revenues that you're producing as a owner instead of an employee, you also get a higher percentage of revenue on a broader base, which is a really important concept, right? So let's assume that the only revenue that you're getting is a higher percentage of what you're actually producing. Let's not even assume that there's a higher base of revenue. But let's say that, you know, with a 600K revenue practice, you're getting about $200,000 as an associate, an employee. And as an owner, you're getting about, let's say, $270,000 based off of a 45% of revenue collection. So that's a $70,000 per year difference. Now, that to me is a bigger impact than having $500,000 of student loans, because you could pay those off with $50,000 per year in over a 10-year time frame. And that higher income that you're getting, you probably can shield a lot of that with smart tax planning. So you probably are better off, you know, than $50,000 per year in terms of your growth of your net worth potentially. Now, that's again assuming that you're not broadening the revenue base, right? So let's say that, you know, you're producing 600K either way, but now you also get to take, you know, part of the hygiene revenue as the owner and things like that. So let's say that instead of the 600K revenue, it's more like 800, you're taking the 45% of that. So now you're over 300K in income. Another thing that could really mess you up, and this is pay attention if you're, you know, any occupation, obviously, you know, your marriage. If you get married and you have no prenup, then the joke goes, you're betting half your stuff, you're going to love someone forever, right? And they're going to love you forever. That's the other part of that. So invest like crazy in your marriage. Your holiday gift list is actually one of the best investments you can possibly make. You know, so even if you ever feel like, you know, your spouse wants something that's like, oh, that's a little silly, like, you know, we don't really need that. Well, you know what? At the end of the day, making your spouse feel loved, communicating, taking the time to invest in that relationship, that is so important. Dr. Howard Foran hosts the Dentistry Uncensored podcast, and one of his favorite jokes is he goes into his rant voice and he goes, $500,000 in student loans is nothing. Your first divorce will cost you $3 million. You know, he's joking, and it happened to him, and it can happen to really any of us. And so you have to be real careful with that too. You know, so, you know, you're worried about student loans. I mean, honestly, you should be a lot more worried about making sure you have a successful marriage than whether or not you have a huge student loan balance. You know, you also want to be more focused on making the right decisions for your career than your student loan balance. So anyhow, if you are this dentist that's got $500,000 of student loan debt, at most you lose about 20% of your income, because you're going to lose a little bit for your tax bomb that you're putting away for every month. And you're also going to lose, you know, the 10% for your pay as you earn or something like that. So if you're making, even if you're only making $120,000 as an employee, yeah, you're working hard. Yeah, you're doing a lot of physical stuff, but you know, you're probably going to lose $25,000 to student loans and you're left over with $95,000. So my question is this, is that bad? I mean, $95,000 income for a job that's going to be recession proof, right? You're going to get hit with problems at times for sure in terms of like industry changes and just a more difficult environment to practice and a lot of stress and things. Yes, I mean, I'm not pretending that that doesn't happen, but to make that $95,000 potential net salary with also having all the upside of being a practice owner and having a fairly straightforward path to success there, I mean, there's a lot to like about that. Now, obviously, you might say, well, shoot, if I could have done it over again, I would have gone and been a whatever, fill in the blank, right? I would have gone to business school. I would have done, you know, no grad school at all. I would have just gone to work for some, you know, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, you know, you can do that all day, but that's not going to be a helpful thing. You know, that's a useful emotion to just feel and just get it out of your system and just acknowledge that emotion, because that is important. But once you're past that point of, okay, what do I do now? You know, you just have to realize, like, does it make more sense now with where I am in life to be a dentist or a dental practice owner or employee or whatever compared to doing something totally different? That's the question you're asking yourself. So let's do a very different example. Sometimes I get occasional hate mail, and sometimes we do focus too much on the higher income earning folks out there. But occasionally I'll get hate mails that goes something like this. Oh, you only care about the people that earn a bunch of money, and you don't care about these regular people like me that, you know, only earn $40,000-$50,000. And so, you know, how can we trust what you're saying? Well, I mean, we do talk about everybody with student loan planner, but you know, sometimes we don't talk maybe enough about a lot of those people that are not earning six-figure incomes. So let's talk about a field or occupation example too, where most people do not make six-figure incomes. We're going to talk about chiropractors. So if you look at the college scorecard data, this is a report that was just released in a month ago. I looked at all these different programs and it reported median earnings and debt for all these different fields. And chiropractic looked like a total disaster. So basically you had typical debts of like $200,000 to $250,000. And then you had median earnings for the people first year out of school were like $30,000 on average. So you had a debt-to-income ratio of around, I think, 7-1. And so let's just get this off the table. I mean, based off of those statistics, I'm not going to say everybody, but on average, chiropractic education is a scam. I mean, if you're looking at a debt-to-income ratio of 7-1, and you're looking at just based off of the median debt and median earnings data alone, I've heard so many times that chiropractic schools tell their students you're going to earn $100,000. It's going to be a great career. It's going to be so easy. You're going to pay it back in no time. And those are just falsehoods. And you could say that maybe those are unintentional falsehoods where the person's saying something that, you know, they don't know is not correct, or it's something maybe active that they do know is not correct, but the schools just tell them to say it, so they say it. Either way, it's not true. Yeah, we have had clients make over $80,000 as a chiropractor, but it's not the common result. The common result is this $50,000 level. And so you might say, well, okay, I'm scammed and I can't do anything about it and I just need to hang my hat up and cry, right? No, that's not true. So why are you still okay? It's because you can still make a decent living. Say you only are making $50,000, all right? Well, hopefully you're going to an area that's not super saturated. You know, hopefully you're not in a place that's super expensive to live. You know, there's a lot of chiropractors that seem to locate in Portland for whatever reason. And, you know, if you think about that, that can be a big issue with chiropractors just trying to, they're having too high of a supply and also a high cost of living, and it's just very difficult to make it there. You can either be a successful chiropractor, and again, you're losing probably 10 to 20% of your income going for a taxable strategy, and hopefully you just enjoy doing the work more, making $50,000 a year doing that than you would making $50,000 a year traveling on the road and selling widgets for some company. So if you like what you do more, then it's still a good decision. Now, say that you're like, wow, I would kill to make $80,000 in income a year and have a more stable lifestyle and not have to deal with all the stresses of owning a business, and it's just not for me. And I would give anything to have made a different decision and take a different career. Well, if that's you, then what I would suggest is if you already have $250,000 of loans, pile on another $100,000 or $200,000 and go back to school and maybe try to become a physician assistant or a nurse practitioner or something like that. We've had several chiropractors go on to different careers because they've decided it's not for them. And what happens is the percentage of your income pretty much stays the same. Your payments are not really changing if you have $400,000 or $500,000 in debt or $200,000. And if you can end up with a $80,000 income with no stress of owning your own business versus $50,000 of income with the stress of owning your own business, then that is just an example of basically a smart decision to go back to school in that case. Or if you really enjoy chiropractic, then you try to make the most of it. You go to conferences, you do all the work, you do research, and you know, and that works out pretty well because you just try to be more frugal, you know, than you otherwise might want to be. And then you also have to maybe try to reflect some of your working class patients' spending habits instead of doctor spending habits, right? And if you can do that, then you'll be just fine. You either make the best of the situation you're in, or you go back and get a different degree that actually would potentially give you the returns you're looking for. So either way, if you're a chiropractor, you're going to be okay. Now let's look at occupation number two, becoming a lawyer. Let's say that you work as a big law attorney, and you could do multiple things with this. You could maybe refinance to a five-year term and just say, okay, I've got $300,000 of law school debt. I can afford $6,000 a month. I'm making $170,000 a year. I'm going to go ahead and refinance, and I'm going to be able to afford $6,000 a month, and I'll be able to pay my rent, maybe max out my 401k and have a little bit of money left over, and that's it. And you work your tail off, and you pay down your debt. Once your debt is gone, then you maybe switch over to different, more exciting career paths if you're not a big law person. Or alternatively, one thing we've done is we've helped a couple people make big law escape plans. So in other words, what you do is you stash money for a year or two, build up a bunch of savings in the bank, you maximize your 401ks, you put some money into your investment accounts, and you don't worry about your debt. You continue to make your income-driven payments, or potentially you might even look at doing a strategic forbearance. For example, you can get that $0 per month payment when you graduate, right? For 12 months after graduation, if you consolidate the right way and use your income tax to certify the right way. So that means for your first year of big law, you probably would have a payment of zero. And then the second year, your payment would be based off of half of a year's taxable income. Say that that's 170 divided by two. So you're basing it on like half of that, 85, 90K, something like that. So then your payment would be 500 a month. And if you're getting forgiveness credit towards the 20 years that you need at zero or 500 a month, and that's probably worthwhile. But then let's say in your third year of big law, you still are planning on your exit, but then your required payment comes back and it's 1200 a month. And your plan is to become a lower earning attorney or a public service attorney or something like that. Well, then you might do a strategic forbearance, which is basically pausing the payments for 12 months and then restarting the payments when they start counting towards forgiveness in the way that you want them to again. So there's an example of a big law attorney with a bunch of debt, with a bunch of income, who's not actually trapped there, unless they want to be there, in which case, yeah, then you would want to maybe do a refinance and try to get rid of the debt the traditional way. You know, we have on our site, on our main refi page, studentloanplanner.com/refi, we have all the links there. I mean, you can refinance probably with a 3-point-something% fixed rate for a five-year term. There's rates that are below 2 now for variable, like 1.8, 1.9. And this is always, you know, subject to change, of course. And then also, you know, we have First Republic Bank on our refinancing page where you can get their cash bonus and get a super low fixed rate. I think sometimes it's below 2%. So, you know, you can really pay back your debt in a hurry, or you can use forgiveness plans to strategically craft your life where you don't have to work as a corporate attorney for your life. And then obviously, if you're not a big law attorney, your student loans don't make you trapped. It's just kind of a similar story to a chiropractor or a dentist who has a high debt to income ratio. You're doing your money into your tax bomb, your money into your loans, probably maximum 20% of your income. And you just hope that you enjoy doing legal work more than you would have enjoyed doing other things. And you hope that the net income, once you deduct the 20% that gets eaten by your loans, you hope that that is a decent amount to live on. Now let's look at occupation example 4 of why you shouldn't really worry about your loans because student loans don't matter. So number 4 is that debt adds stress as a physician, right? So let's say you're a physician and you have, I don't know, $300,000 of student loans. You know, you already have so much stress as a physician. So as a doc, I mean, my wife is a physician, you know, she's always more stressed about her patients are doing than her loans. That's just a really good example of the hours of training, the toll that takes on you as a doc and also on your family, the lack of control over where you live during different times of your life. Like we just had some close friends that thought that they were going to be relocating on the West Coast closer to family, and then they got through the match process and they found out, congratulations, you know, you're matched exactly where you were for med school in a city where they didn't want to be. And it's like a 6-year program. So it's like, oh man, you know, talk about that kind of toll and then add in debt on top of that. It's just, it can be debilitating. And also I've noticed on Facebook groups for physicians, you know, PSLF, I mean, goodness sakes. I mean, sometimes I wonder if it's good to just axe the whole program in general so that physicians would stop having panic attacks. I mean, I see panic attacks online all the time. Like, oh my gosh, is it going to be there? I'm going to leave. I'm going to stay in my job. Like, I can't figure out what to do. And people freak out. And really, I mean, as good as PSLF is, and don't get me wrong, this is somebody that we routinely find somebody, you know, $100,000 of savings sometimes when they're not using PSLF the right way, right? But it's not as important as you think it is. Because in any high-paying field in medicine specifically, you're probably going to earn more in private practice than the value of PSLF would be, even after adjusting for taxes. Now, if you're in a primary care field or like pediatric something, then yeah, there might be some significant benefit in doing PSLF versus private practice. We've been in some cases where we've had like pediatric oncologists and folks like that have been in a situation where, yeah, they work for the children's hospital and their value of PSLF on a pre-tax basis is like, you know, 150 grand a year. We've been in situations like that. But for most folks that are dealing with a high amount of debt that are doing one of the lower paying specialties of medicine, you can go for the 20-year forgiveness and that still works out just fine. So if you do not want to be in an academic setting, you'd rather have a little bit more income, that's totally okay. Your loans shouldn't hold you down as a physician. A recent case that I had this couple that really wanted to travel, and they thought that the idea of doing locums would have been the best thing ever. But they felt super held down by their loans. You know, she had a lot of loans, I think over $400,000 from a private medical school. And she thought that her options were to move to the West Coast, work at one of those kind of nonprofit places for PSLF. So a more desirable place to live, but you're not going to save any money. Or you can move to a low-cost living area and get PSLF, or you can move to a low-cost living area and do private practice and make a little bit more. And they were just paralyzed. And so we discussed the different options and showed her how the best thing to do based off of what they wanted to do was to go ahead and take one of the higher earning jobs in low-cost living area, stash away a ton of cash and savings and investments and things like that, and then to quit and not to refinance her loans. Because when you do that locums lifestyle, you could, again, use strategic forbearance. You could, you know, come back to a not-for-profit facility once you're ready to settle down. Let's say that if you had kids, for example. And if you really love that locums lifestyle, there's just all kinds of things you could do to lower your income, lower your student loan payment, get subsidies on something like revised pay as you earn while you're figuring your life out. And if your debt's growing at a managed rate, then you can get it to grow maybe at like, you know, 3-5% per year on a government subsidy program. And it's growing at a simple rate of interest, so it's not like it's going to crush you. Really, that's just inflation, and your physician income is going to grow with inflation at least. So there's an example for how this person felt paralyzed by her debt, but in reality, she went from having to do locums and wait 10 years to do that, or 7 years in her case, I think. She needed to wait 7 years to get PSLF. She was so focused on her loans, she didn't see the options that she had. So one more example, because I know this is the holidays and you probably have other better things to be doing with your time. Occupation 5 is pharmacists. Basically, for pharmacists, you know, people in the field know that the job prospects are rapidly deteriorating. One industry thought leader that I talked to has told me that he's expecting 1/3 to a half of all pharmacy graduates to be unemployed at graduation. And that's within a couple of years. And that's really terrible. I mean, imagine that. A third of an entire field just looking for jobs at graduation. That's pretty awful. You really have a lot of similarities to the pharmacist field right now and what happened to the legal field back in like 2011 and 2012. Where you had a lot of schools closed, you had a lot of retraction in the number of seats being offered, you had a lot of truth-telling about the realities of the profession, you had some scandals where schools were hiding employment statistics and doing things that were not accurate. They were basically not being truthful and hiring people for their law school libraries to make them not show up in the unemployment statistics to make their school look better. So I think we'll see stuff like this in the pharmacy field, okay? But if you look at the college scorecard data, which is this professional school like official stats from the Department of Ed, the typical pharmacist just has about $125,000 in debt and $110,000 in income, according to those stats. And that seems like a 1-to-1 debt to income ratio, right? So that seems great. So the problem with that is they pulled all the stats from 2015 and 2016. So the data is already about 3 or 4 years old. And then same thing with the debt data. That data is also not correct. And you know, a lot of pharmacists, I think, have some family help, family assistance. I think sometimes people still try to maybe work a little bit in some cases. So, you know, I think that the debt number is kind of skewed downwards too. With also that data, there was also weird things about it. Like I was looking through that data and it looked like a lot of the schools didn't report everything about their employment prospects. Some seems like some of the schools might have left out residency earnings in that data. So there's all kinds of problems with it. So these are basically statistical crimes, right? Designed to try to make future students think pharmacy is this great deal so people will still sign up for the program. With all that doom and gloom talk though, let's talk about a pharmacist that's got 200,000 of student loans. Real talk, right? Pharmacists can probably get part-time hours, even if it means earning less money. How many pharmacists can earn $50,000 a year working 3 days a week? There's probably a lot, actually. You know, a lot of the new grads are only being offered part-time positions, and that's not what they want. They want the full-time positions. So if you do want the full-time position, then that's obviously not a good thing. But let's say that you've saved up some money and put your emergency fund away. You have no car loan. You've got a house less than 2 times your household income. And you're like, we're pretty good at saving. And so we don't need this full-time income. And so the pharmacist goes to working 3 days a week, making $50,000 a year. You know, if you think about that, that's pretty good. I mean, consider most people are making $50,000 a year working 5 days a week. That's the median household income in America, right? Even in that low income situation, if you're losing 10% or 20% of your income to loans, okay, now you're instead of making $50,000, maybe you're making $40,000. And so that does seem pretty rough for somebody who's got a graduate degree for sure. Don't get me wrong. But my dad had a graduate degree and he was a teacher and he made $40,000 or $50,000. And he said the 3 best reasons to be a teacher were June, July, and August, right? So there's different ways to look at that. If you do have a massive crisis in the pharmacy profession, then maybe what people would have to do is just change their mindset where, hey, there's not a lot of people out there that only have to work 3 days a week. And, you know, making $50,000 a year for working 3 days a week is a pretty cool job. And then also, of course, you can move to where your services are needed and easily get full-time jobs. The problem is a lot of the young pharmacists are clustering around the big cities where a lot of them want to live. So in any of these occupational examples that we gave today, the problem was not the loans, it was the mindset. So for the holiday season, I would suggest that you give yourself the gift of a better mindset. And if you want to give something that's a little bit more physical and practical, obviously we have student loan plans and sometimes people have bought those for their friends or family, but the other thing that you could invest in is our upcoming six-figure debt to six-figure net worth investing course. It's only 2 weeks away. It's going to be located at studentloanplannercourse.com. And this is the best product that we sell outside of our consult. This is something that had hundreds of people sign up for it last time. The price is going to be $399, which sounds like a lot, except it has a money-back guarantee. And I'm almost positive that everybody who takes it is going to pay for that course price in multiples. Just because there's so much that you're just not aware of that can make way more of a difference than getting a 5% raise at work or picking the right mutual fund. It's so much more than that. There's all kinds of tax rules and investment accounts that you need to be aware of and deductions that you're probably missing. And this is what this course is designed to address. So really hope you decide to invest in that if you haven't already, and have a wonderful holiday season. Hopefully you're around those you love, and just really do not let your student loans stress you during this time, because it's not justifiable, even when you look at the math.